You've come to save us from this place. From this place you'll free us.
The exposed brain quivers in expectation.
Please, before they return!
まもなく特急ポット浄土行きが到着します。黄色い線までお下がりください。
Hello everyone and welcome back to another Chill Rant. It's just me again this week. It's Nicholas, it's your boy, it's your dude, it's your... I'm not your sensei, I'm nobody's sensei. Lauren is once again prepping her bunker for the coming apocalypse, so it's just going to be you guys and me listening to some chill beats and talking some chill camera aesthetics. So this is sort of a follow-up to a discussion that Lauren and I had in last week's episode on sort of third-person cameras. I mean, we specifically talked about sort of isometric cameras. And my earlier chill rant on the Final Fantasy VII remake and my own sort of discontent with the way the camera was used in that game. And so, I mean, I strongly suggest going back and listening to both of those, particularly the discussion with Lauren from last week. But if you want sort of the TLDR, I'm basically what it boils down to. So we talked a lot about Baldur's Gate 3 and the use of the isometric camera in the game. I mean, there's actually a mixed camera in the game. Sometimes it comes into sort of like, you know, much closer perspective, sometimes a little over the shoulder, a little sort of like direct, you know, close-up, some ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille action. But for the most part, the gameplay is done in sort of an isometric sort of third-person kind of top-down-ish way. And we talked a lot about sort of our dissatisfaction with that and with the way we thought it really worked in Hades, another somewhat recent game. And really what it boiled down to is the fact that sort of Baldur's Gate 3, I should be more specific, Baldur's Gate 3 can't really figure out what kind of game it's going to be. So on the one hand, there are clear, like, you know, RPG elements, and that would sort of like lead you aesthetically in one direction. While on the other hand, there are also clear, like, tactical elements, and aesthetically that would lead you in another direction. In fact, in many ways, the isometric camera is really ideal for that, because you see it in a lot of tactical games. You see it in, you know, games like XCOM, you see it in, you know, real-time strategy games. You know, it's just a very common way of doing things. You see it in Diablo and so forth and so forth. But the issue in a game like Baldur's Gate 3 is really sort of that RP element. And the way in which that third-person sort of isometric sort of tactical perspective doesn't quite mesh with the gameplay and sort of the overall sort of aesthetic of the game. The TLDR for my Final Fantasy VII remake and also the original Final Fantasy VII was that, in fact, in many ways I made kind of the same point, that sort of in the original Final Fantasy VII, the third-person camera sort of like allows for everything you need to know and everything you need to see to be right there on screen. And in adopting sort of that close third-person camera in the remake, it actually introduces a number of problems. Namely, like the original version, you still have to like control all of your party members, but because you're doing it from this close third-person perspective, it actually makes the game much more difficult, because you're constantly having to switch back and forth between characters without necessarily always knowing like where they are, or what they're doing, etc., etc. Luckily, the AI control in the game is pretty forgiving and will mostly do something not terrible. But I don't know, I see it as not necessarily a gameplay defect, but something that could have had a little more thought put into it. And so here is this basic problem that we're dealing with, is that in a game like Baldur's Gate 3, you have a game that is trying to be really two things simultaneously. But what's interesting about it is that, so in both cases, in fact, in many ways, the Final Fantasy VII Remake and Baldur's Gate 3 kind of present the same problem, but from different perspectives. Because both use a third-person camera, but they're fundamentally different in terms of like what in literary theory we would call subjectivity. So brief introduction. I'm not going to get into all these details because, you know, how narration works in literature is actually very complicated. There are a lot of different axes that you can think about it. You can think about it, you know, in terms of first person, second person, third person, et cetera, you know, limited and et cetera, omniscient and so forth and so forth. But I specifically want to talk about one axis, which is sort of the idea of sort of like objective narration and subjective narration. And the reason why I'm going to talk about narration is because I think there is something really useful here in terms of thinking about how cameras function in games to provide a particular gameplay perspective. Because really what we're talking about when we talk about objective and subjective narration is that we're talking about the perspective of the narrative. Now, sometimes we call that the narrator, but really we should talk about the narrative or the narration, sort of the way in which the story is told. And so an example of sort of an objective narrator is just like sort of your classic sort of disembodied voice that just seems to be describing anything. And in fact, in many ways, there's kind of an example of this in Baldur's Gate. The really wonderful, I wish I would have looked up her name before recording this, but I didn't because I'm a jerk, I guess. But the really, really great sort of that woman's voice, the narrative voice of Baldur's Gate 3 is really fantastic. And that is a form of objective narration. That voice and whoever it represents is not actually involved in the narrative and is not constrained by its limits. Whereas a form of subjective narration is oftentimes someone who is actually like involved in the story. So for example, actually Hades is a really good example of this. There is an objective narrator, but also at the same time, like Zagreus himself kind of functions as a sort of subjective narrator, or even sort of like the individual characters themselves. Like, you know, when he talks to Nyx and Nyx explains something to him, that's a form of, in many ways, subjective narration, even though it's also conversation between the two of them. Because, I mean, what's interesting about a game, unlike, say, a work of literature, is that in a game, oftentimes a conversation is specifically designed to tell you something about what's going on in the game. And so that's why I point to those conversations with Nyx, specifically in Hades, because, you know, you're not just having a chat with her. She is explaining the world to you. She is, in many ways, narrating it for you as the player. Now, what's interesting is that objective and subjective narrative perspectives actually exist on a continuum. They might seem like they're mutually exclusive, like either you're involved and constrained by, you know, the world that is being related, or you're not. However, there are actual historical literary examples of a way in which you can kind of move freely back and forth between the two of these. And this is usually referred to as free indirect discourse or free indirect speech, or sometimes it's just called free indirect. And sort of the classic author for thinking about this particular style of narration is Jane Austen. And so I want to read a paragraph and a bit from her novel Persuasion to kind of show you how this works. So this is very early on in chapter one. So it goes, "This very awkward history of Mr. Elliot was still, after an interval of several years, felt with anger by Elizabeth." Note, this is Elizabeth Elliot. This is the main character, Anne Elliot's older sister. Okay, back to the story. "Who had liked the man for himself," that is Mr. Elliot, "and still more for being her father's heir, and whose strong family pride could see only in him a proper match for Sir Walter Elliot's eldest daughter." In other words, Elizabeth thought that he should be married to her. "There was not a baronet from A to Z whom her feelings could have so willingly acknowledged as an equal. Yet so miserably had he conducted himself that though she was at this present time, the summer of 1814, wearing black ribbons for his wife, she could not admit him to be worth thinking of again. The disgrace of his first marriage might, perhaps, as there was no reason to suppose it perpetuated by offspring, have been got over had he not done worse. But he had. As by the customary intervention of kind friends they had been informed, spoken most disrespectfully of them all, most slightingly and contemptuously of the very blood he belonged to, and the honors which were hereafter to be his own. This could not be pardoned." Okay, now before I read the next sentence, I want to note that So the way this paragraph works is that it seems like it's just sort of that like top down, like omniscient objective narration, sort of what we would kind of expect from like, you know, regular ordinary third person narrative in a text. However, Austin goes on to say, such were Elizabeth Elliot's sentiments and sensations, such the cares to alloy, the agitations to vary, the sameness and the elegance, the prosperity and the nothingness of her scene of life. In other words, that entire paragraph that I read just before that sentence, though it initially appears to be a form of objective narration, it is actually subjective, because it was, as the text later reveals, inside Elizabeth Elliot's head. In other words, this is the way she saw the world, even though it was presented in a manner that seemed to be as if it were objective. And so this is what is typically meant by free indirect discourse, where sort of you're going along in normal, like ordinary sort of omniscient third person narration, but for a moment the text kind of goes into a character's head and presents their thoughts as if they were an objective perspective. So where do we see examples of this in video games? Because, you know, if the whole point of this is to think about how, like, you know, literary theory can help inform our thoughts about sort of the aesthetics of video games, a really good example of this basically exists in nearly all survival horror games. But I want to focus on Resident Evil and Silent Hill, specifically Silent Hill 2. In fact, actually, I'll start with Silent Hill 2. So Silent Hill 2 does this in a lot of ways. So for one, there's the fact that sort of when you're playing as James in the game, even though you have that kind of classic third person over the shoulder perspective, although the camera can and often does shift around him, but it always shifts in really limited ways. In other words, the perspective is still fairly constrained. So there is that constraint, the fact that it's sort of the camera is all, regardless of its position, is always somewhat close up in on him. Additionally, there is a kind of, you know, fog of war in the game where you, even though you can see a much broader area, you can only actually see things in the environment of the game within, say, what would probably be something like a 10-foot radius around the character that you're controlling. And you see that literally as a fog. And as you move, the fog dissipates and you can see it again. But what's interesting about that sort of foggy perspective is you can hear a lot more oftentimes than you can see. In other words, you can often hear creatures and zombies and all sorts of weird occultish things much earlier than you can see them. And sort of that the way that that forced constrained perspective sort of builds anticipation, it builds fear, it builds anxiety in a really natural way, because, you know, this is how people often react, say, you know, when they're in the dark and they hear something, you know, anything of that sort. But on the one hand, you could look at sort of the camera perspective in a game like Silent Hill 2 as sort of emblematic of, you know, the classic like third person over the shoulder. And, you know, you see this in the Final Fantasy VII remake. You've seen it in a lot of games. You see it in the Dragon Age games. You see it, you know, you see it literally all over the place. But it's not just the camera. And sort of really what the brilliance of that game is sort of stems from the fact that like all of the aesthetic pieces are pointing towards the same goal. In other words, you have the somewhat close-in constrained camera, you have the sort of like the fog in the environment, and then another aspect of the game which I think is actually really brilliant and to me very explicitly points to this sort of notion of sort of like a limited third person subjectivity, or sort of what in, you know, literary terms we call, you know, free indirect discourse, has to do with actually a lot of the bad things in the game. Because, okay, so I'm not necessarily one to do the whole like spoiler alert thing, but, you know, I realize that people who play video games like to have things not spoiled for them. So to be perfectly honest, I'm about to spoil Silent Hill 3 for you, so, you know, I would suggest maybe skipping forward a couple of minutes, or maybe just turning the podcast off right now, because I've kind of already made my point. Anyway, so, okay, there's your warning. And now the really brilliant thing in the game, sort of in addition to sort of like, as I said, the constrained camera, the sort of the fog of war, if you will, there is also the way in which you learn later that many of the things that James encounters as part of sort of the quote-unquote objective environment in the game are actually manifestations of his own psyche. And so a good example of this is the classic Silent Hill character, the pyramid head, the dude with like the red pyramid-shaped helmet head thing, who initially appears in the game as this like menacing, threatening presence, a very sort of aggressive and sexually violent character. And when you first encounter the dude, for lack of a better term, in the game, it's really kind of unclear what exactly it is he's supposed to be, what he represents, like what does his presence mean for the character James? And then it's later revealed that in many ways Pyramid Head sort of represents James's own sexual frustration. And so literally in this case, so in the same way that sort of that objective narration in Austin's Persuasion goes into Elizabeth Elliot's head and sort of uses her perspective to sort of like create the objective world of the narration, we see in Silent Hill 2 the way in which sort of Pyramid Head kind of represents a similar thing, where it's the sort of the world of the town of Silent Hill has gone into James's head, sort of pulled this like sort of intense, almost like Freudian anxiety out of his brain and made it into like a literal physical manifestation within his quote unquote objective environment. I mean, you could argue that there's no such thing as an objective perspective in a Silent Hill game, but that's what I mean. And sort of that is an example of a game that does this very brilliantly, where it sort of moves back and forth between the subjective and the objective. And it's not just about the camera. It's not just about sort of the perspective that you're given in terms of the fog of war, but it's also about the way in which things that manifest in the game derive from the specific subjectivity of the character who becomes your avatar, who is the player's focus. And so that's an excellent example of all the ways in which these things sort of like come together. But in the Silent Hill, sorry, not Silent Hill, in the Resident Evil games, and I'm thinking especially of something that I noticed in the remake, the HD remake of Resident Evil 2, where oftentimes like the camera will move in very, very close, almost sort of like right next to the player character's, like the side of their face, and you'll literally be staring at, in terms of your own visual field, it almost becomes the closest thing you can get to a first person perspective while still technically being in that sort of like that third person camera perspective. And then it'll move back out, or you'll have different angles, but the camera really becomes a means by which to demonstrate to you as a player both of the subjectivity of the character and the way in which your own subjectivity as a player is being mapped upon it. So those two I think are really excellent examples of the sort of way in which sort of the seamless, the sort of non-distinction between objective and subjective. And Baldur's Gate 3, to its credit, kinda tries to do this. I mean, it does it really well in terms of sort of the character interactions. In other words, what we might consider like the more RP elements of the game, where it comes in really close. You know, you have a close-in shot of, you know, your own character. You often have close-in shots of, you know, the characters in your party, and then whichever other sort of like major like NPC you happen to be interacting with at the time. That is actually an example of something that the game does really well. And like I said before, it's not just about the camera perspective. The reason why those RP interactions work so well is because of oftentimes the voice acting, which is excellent in the game, but also the integration of the narrator and that narrative voice, which literally sort of it's like crawling inside of your mind, because the narrative voice of the game is not just like explaining to you what happens to be going on in any given moment. It's like literally inside of your head, both as the character and as the player, telling you what's going on and telling you the meaning or the significance of things that are happening to you. In other words, so to use a very, very, very early example in the game, so that way there aren't any like turbo spoilers. So there's a moment in the beginning of the near the beginning of the game, shortly after the Illithid Nautiloid has crashed. No, actually, it's even before the Nautiloid has crashed. And you go into this room and you see this body and there's sort of an exposed brain and the brain starts talking to you. So you have both the brain kind of in your mind as the character and as the player talking to you. But then you also have this narrative voice talking to you in a similar way to try and like explain to you sort of the condition of the brain and then give you, you know, explanation of, you know, your options of what you could do to, you know, pull it out, et cetera, et cetera, you know, maybe cripple it, et cetera, et cetera. And so what's really interesting about that moment, if you think critically about it, you sort of think, you know, what exactly is going on here in terms of how the game is sort of explaining to you how it works and how it's going to be like talking to you, like in many ways sort of the game, like the narrative voice, because of the way it interacts with you as the player character, is kind of going to interact with you. It's going to interact with you in much the same way as this talking brain creature interacts with you. It is the sort of voice in your head. And so I think the fact that the game begins with this Illithid encounter, it's not just about sort of, you know, setting up the, I guess you could say, the initial story arc and, you know, what your character is going to do and like how you have to like all the complicated things that you have to go through. But it's also telling you how the game is going to relate to you. And sort of that is and the reason why I think I love the voice acting so much is precisely because like that is an example of where sort of like the close in camera perspective and the way the game is talking to you and the specific encounters that you have to go through, like they're all meshing, they're all working together. The problem that both Lauren and I identified is that while all of that is working together in an almost seamless way, the overworld and sort of the combat encounters kind of aren't working with it in that way. And, you know, that may have just been, you know, a choice having to deal with like the particular engine that the designers were using, that Larian was using. I mean, they could have made these decisions for any number of reasons, and I don't want to take them to task for it. But I want to, if anyone is listening to me, I want to kind of explain why I think that it's not quite working. And it's not quite working because the isomorphic camera, and particularly the way in which like combat is designed in the game, that piece isn't fitting in with that sort of like free indirect discourse perspective that the camera and the RP elements and the narration are all pointing towards. In other words, those three elements are all pointing very clearly in a particular direction, whereas the isomorphic 3D perspective otherwise points in a completely different direction. So it's not just that, you know, the game is trying to beam many things simultaneously. There are many games that sort of like find a way to merge like multiple like aesthetic approaches. I think the problem is that the way in which, like, on the one hand, the narration and the close-in camera and the RP elements are done points towards one way of thinking about how the game functions in these more sort of like limited subjective narrative terms, whereas the sort of the isomorphic like tactical approach to combat and to movement throughout the overworld points in a completely different direction, more towards, you know, a classic, you know, more towards real-time strategy games, towards Diablo, towards, you know, games that can be like RPGs but are a different kind of RPG. And so really there's a fundamental identity crisis there. Now, at the end of the day, this doesn't really take away, in my opinion, from how enjoyable Baldur's Gate 3 is to play. It's more just that, like, you have to recognize that because these things point in different directions, you're going to possibly elicit in your player a kind of frustration because of that disconnect. And so that's the point that I wanted to leave you all with this week as you're relaxing and hopefully avoiding the plague and, you know, maybe just generally getting on with your life. And if you're in the United States, staying alive, despite the fact that our government is doing next to nothing to protect us from a deadly pandemic. Sorry for the political rant there at the end, but them's the breaks. All right. So if you like what you hear, of course, always listen to our regular episodes. They're fantastic. You'll not have to listen to just me. You'll get Lauren's perspective as well, since she actually is a game designer. You can follow both of us on Twitter. Lauren is at the Lauren Ash, and it's Lauren, L-A-U-R-Y-N, the Lauren Ash. And she's also on Instagram as well. So if you're interested in Lauren's thoughts on things, you know, it's always a good place to go. You can follow me as well. I run the Furidashi Pod on Twitter. Sorry, it's actually just Furidashi Pod on Twitter. I also have my own personal account in which I often rant about Japanese studies related things, and that's UAHSENAA. I'm not going to explain to you where that name comes from. All right, that's it for this week. As I said, I hope you guys are all staying safe. You're staying healthy. I hope the holidays aren't getting you down, and we will be back again next week with a regular episode. Bye-bye.